co-host, Michael. What's up, man?
Not too much. Just hanging out.
Feeling ambivalent?
I mean, I would say that's more of a lifestyle choice than a feeling, but yeah, still living the ambivalent life.
So I was listening to last week's episode. Sometimes I'll do that. Like, I'll be like, all right, well, how can we improve? That episode was really long. What can we do to make it a little bit better? So I'll listen to the podcast and think about things. And after I mentioned the ambivalent thing, you actively used other words.
I know. I definitely did. I mean, that's actually kind of interesting feedback. And I'm happy to attempt to improve my vocabulary if that improves the listening experience.
I'm obviously ambivalent about you using the word ambivalent, but I will say that when Casey got called out for saying absolutely on every episode, I think he literally removed the word from his vocabulary.
Yeah, he just never said it again.
Yeah. I mean, he also stopped eating grilled cheese. Like, the podcast is pretty rough on Casey. So.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, so. You know, no one knows my food habits yet, so.
Yeah, apparently it's eat Taco Bell while you're in Hawaii for breakfast.
Well, I mean, that was mostly just laziness, but you know, we had to be there and soon we were walking. So that's what
it is. There were some people that didn't have very much laziness when it came to this week. So last week on the show, I jokingly said, if you can't afford to become a patron, but you can afford to remove Comcast as your, you know, provider for your internet, you can do that instead to support the show because of all the crap that we've gotten from Comcast lately. And three people did it.
That seems like a lot.
Right?
Yeah.
It's so many people. Like, when it was happening, I was like, oh no, am I going to get in trouble? Like, can they sue me? I feel like they might be able to sue me.
Well, or just like, you know, I wouldn't base my internet decisions off a podcast, but. I mean, well, Comcast at least worst, not an though. Not an internet related. If it was like an internet related podcast, I wouldn't base my internet decisions off a magic related podcast.
Sure.
As well, a general life rule.
I did say that I would give them a shout out on the podcast. So shout out to Andrew E, Todd K, and Stephen F for all removing your Comcast. I don't know what you guys switched to, but I hope it's better. It can't be worse.
I mean, so. You say that, but.
Well, either way, thank you guys for your support, I guess.
A non-traditional support. It's appreciated regardless.
Let's go on to our first segment. So every week on the show, we invite our listeners of the show that are patrons of the show. So you can't get this segment by getting rid of your Comcast. But if you donate to the show via patreon.com/ccmtg, you're invited to ask a Patreon question through our Patreon participation segment, which is this one. So Sean I asks, is it possible to over metagame? I keep pretty current and build my deck to anticipate expected trends. However, I find that my LGS has not caught up. My deck is not tuned properly. Is it just a problem of being of an inbred local metagame? And the fact is that the people are can't see because I'm like wearing contacts.
And the fact that I am playing more locally as opposed to at bigger regional events.
Go ahead, Michael.
Yeah, I mean, this is definitely true. Like, you have to build your decks with what you're actually likely to play in mind. You know, if you know there's one guy who's always going to be playing. This happens a lot, probably. This probably happens more in Modern than in Standard. But, like, you know what people are going to play, right? You know what the people who play at your LGS are going to play. If you're playing it like a GP, it's a little bit different. But I think there's a lot to be said for. We're back to the whole, like, you know, getting in a car accident because you want to be technically right thing, right? You can be right and still get hit by a car, and, like, you know, who really wins then? Right, in the same sense that you can, like,
this is a hard question.
You can metagame your deck, and it's nice to know that you can predict what's happening on, like, a larger level, but if it's costing you matches at a local level and you're mostly playing at a local level, I would say you can definitely be too far ahead of the curve.
Yeah, there's a fine line in between, like, putting Emrakuls in your sideboard to combat mill decks, and that, like, that one person plays at your event, right? Or adjusting because there's more Mardu vehicles than there is other decks in the format. So it just kind of depends, because there's a line that you can't cross, right? Which is the inbreeding to your local metagame. But there is a line that's like, okay, I know that there are a lot of Mardu players at PPTQs in my local metagame, so I'm going to play Aether Meltdown in my main deck as a 2-of instead of 2 Magma Sprays.
I just don't expect to play zombies or whatever, right? Right. I mean,
exactly.
Yeah, I think ultimately if you're playing an event where the prizes make you care more about winning than about being right, it absolutely makes sense to play the list. Like, I would rather win than be correct if I have to choose one.
Here's my problem with the advice that we're kind of giving right now, is that I honestly believe that if you just bring the best version of your deck, you're just almost always going to have a higher chance to win any given match. So I don't like saying that you can prepare for your local FNM, because I don't think it's true. I think that, like, it's too likely that you're going to play against something you're not going to prepare for at that level, and just bringing the best version of your deck is just a better idea.
Yeah, so I guess it depends on how you separate best version versus best version for a metagame that just doesn't exist, right? I mean, I'm not trying to play a bunch of, like, main deck declaration in stones if no one's playing zombies locally, right? I mean, it's more about not going overboard in, like, playing cards that are only good in specific matchups. That, because sometimes on like a larger tournament scale, things like that can be correct, where you can really play some unusual choices and some weird slots where maybe it's not the best version of the deck in a vacuum, but it's very good for that metagame. And I think just being aware that that's a thing that can happen will help you separate sort of the best version of a deck in total from the best version of a deck for a given week or a given event.
I'm kind of lost. What advice are we giving here?
Basically, my advice would be, don't go super like, so if you see someone else play Declaration in Stone and it's really good against zombies, but you never play against zombies, I wouldn't play Declaration in Stone. Right? Something can be like good technology hypothetically, but not good technology for your metagame. That's what I would think of as like over metagaming.
Yeah, I'm gonna say that I don't know the correct answer to this, because I don't know where you're at. So for me, I found the most success in bringing the deck that I believe is the best deck to a given PPTQ. Those are the times where I win. I find that when I try and predict what a bunch of people are going to do at a local level is really hard, because, like, it's at that level where there can be just huge changes, because, like, there's just not as much on the line, right? They're just less likely.
No, it's totally true that people bounce around more for events like that.
Yeah. It's just too hard for me to say, like, that you are going to get it right at a local level. I don't know.
It's hard to give a definitive answer. Yeah, it's really hard to give a definitive answer. But I wouldn't play something. I wouldn't play something because someone else thinks it's good if it doesn't work for you.
Oh yeah.
I think ultimately, right, like, just because something won a Star City Games this week doesn't necessarily mean that it makes sense to be playing for you.
Yeah.
I think that's about all the advice you can give, right?
Yeah, and I would say that there's the thing that I would say is that there's a line, right? You know, we did a podcast like 4 weeks ago on how not to win your FNM, and this was kind of a topic in it. We kind of went more in depth of, like, don't bring two decks and then switch decks according to who your round one opponent is, because you know what they typically play. Like, you're just going to, like, lose more matches of Magic that way than you're going to win. But, like, this is kind of in a similar vein, right? So it's interesting that we would give slightly different advice for this.
I would say this is just a little more nuanced.
Right, because I think what's important here is we're talking about maybe changing one or two cards versus changing and, like, not jamming, like, an Emrakul into your sideboard to waste a slot versus mill decks. Like, we might be talking about, like, similar to the Genesis guys having a Tomb of Aether in their main deck, right? So it's just a little bit different.
Yeah, a lot of it comes down to, like, what are your goals for the event, right? If winning the event is the most important thing, so if you're, like, playing a PPTQ and you need to win this one, it makes sense to me that I'm not going to play cards that I distinctly think will be bad against what I expect other people to bring.
Sure.
For the sake of learning. But at, like, an FNM, I might be more interested in just sort of seeing how these cards line up in different matchups, even if they're maybe not the absolute best choice for that exact metagame.
Okay. All right. Well, let's wrap that up. So that is a really long-winded, not too definitive answer for your question, Sean, but...
Magic is tough. And
it kind of depends on your goals. So if you ask me, like, if I had to give you, like, a gun to my head, I would just tell you to play the best version of the deck, the version that you believe is the best for any given event, right? So
that seems like good advice in general, right?
So
if you end up playing the best deck consistently, you're probably going to do a lot of winning.
Yeah. Thank you so much to you, Sean, for supporting the show, and we're happy to answer your question. You can support the show too by going to just go to the homepage. So if you go to constructivecriticism.com, there's lots of ways to support the show. You can go to our swag page. You can check out our sponsor at Wasted Games. You can get 15% off of your first order by using the code CCMTG at checkout. You can get 4% off of every order by using the code Would That Be Good. They are just a great place to buy Magic card. They're opening a new awesome location coming this year. So if you're in Utah, it's going to be sweet, guys. It's going to be sweet. And if you're not, it's just they're hiring more employees and they're just going to be able to fulfill more orders. And it's going to be amazing. So check them out, OasisGamesSLC.com and MTGOasis.com. You can also support the show by just hitting that donation button on PayPal right on the homepage. It's really easy. A lot of people ask, like, oh, I don't want to become a patron, but I want to support the show. How to do one-time donations? There is a button for it. Just go to Patreon. Just go to constructivecriticism.com and hit the donation button that's sitting right there. Let's move on. Let's go into our next segment, which is hashtag always improving. Hashtag always improving is really the point of this podcast. We believe if you're not getting better, you're getting worse. We want to be doing what we can every week to try and improve at Magic the Gathering and life in general. Michael, what did you do to improve at life in general at Magic the Gathering this week?
I've just been taking time trying to still focus on getting prepped for GP Vegas, as well as the RPTQ next weekend. So I've had the chance to play some Sealed this week a little more than I have in the past month or so, which is nice. Good to get a little bit of a feel for that format. And then trying to figure out exactly what I'd like to play for Legacy and Modern. So just trying to keep upping preparation, kind of ramping up to those events. Because they are probably the best chance that I have at getting silver this year.
Awesome. I am kind of in, I think most of the players in our, well, you're in a different situation than me, but most players in, like, a situation like me who are, like, qualified for an RPTQ, going to Vegas, having to play in PPTQs, it's just a lot of formats to prepare for at once. It's not something that I've really had to deal with for a long time. And, but lately in Magic, I have felt like I've been getting a little unlucky. And so this weekend at the PPTQ, I played in round one, I played against a matchup. I played blue-red, splash-white for Cast Out and Nahiri and Spell Call out of the board. So just basically a free splash of white with some four drops and then Spell Callers. And, you know, I felt like, after testing, that the deck had a really good matchup against Marvel, Zombies, and Mardu. And then I'm pretty okay in the control mirror, so I felt okay with that. And Spell Queller I really like in the control mirror. Round one, I played against a deck that played main deck Sphinx of the Final Word, main deck 3-mana Gideon, main deck Jace, Counterspells. It was like... and it was not fun. And round two, I got really unlucky. I kept a 3-lander and didn't draw land. And I sat there, you know, talking to people, and I was like, man, I haven't had like a turn of fun Magic this tournament. And they're like, oh, are you gonna drop? And I was like, you know what? No, I'm not. I'm gonna actually just finish this entire tournament. And the reason, knowing that I couldn't make top eight, that I was willing to do that is I don't want to go into the RBDQ feeling unlucky. Like, I'd rather be my last memories of Magic not be that. So I won my next, all the rest of the rounds in the tournament. I won every single round I played, and I played against Zombies, Control, and Marvel, and beat all of them. And, you know, it just told me that, like, when it comes to these kind of events, like, sometimes you're gonna play against nonsense, and you're not gonna be prepared for it. And you can't just win them all. But it also told me that, like, if I keep my win percentage at what I want it to be, right, that 65 to 70%, like, I'm just going to top eight of a lot of events and give myself a lot of chances to win. And that's good enough for me. So I kind of just did what I could to keep myself grounded this week and just not be upset about something that I could have been upset about.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that just like mindset goes into it a lot too. It's easy to kind of tilt off and spiral down if you let yourself.
Yeah. And honestly, I just want Magic to be fun. So, I remembered how I felt after Pro Tour Origins and like feeling like I was unlucky and like nothing would ever go my way. And I just don't want to have that feeling. So I kind of like forced my way through it, which is, by the way, not that fun of an experience, but it was worth it. I feel really good now.
Happy to hear that. I think it's hard not to get caught up in that a little bit when you feel like things are breaking against you for whatever reason.
Yeah.
But ultimately, it's just not a very productive feeling to have, right? If it's honestly like luck or pairings or whatever, there's just not really anything you can do about it besides slog through and keep making the best plays you can.
Yeah, I hope that it helps me out. Like, I want to be in the mindset that I was during my first RPTQ this time around. So let's move on. So this week we don't have a deck doctor this week, but if you are a patron of $5 or more per month, you can be one of our constructor critics and submit deck doctors every week on the show. We will go over your deck list and talk about what we love, what we would change, and where we think the deck stands today. So go to patreon.com/ccmtg to become a patron of the show and submit a deck doctor, and we'd be happy to talk about your list. Let's go to our next segment, which is card of the week. So every week on the show, we give out some magical cards. This week, we want to give out a card that is, in my opinion, actually just overperforming. Like, by a huge margin, actually. I actually think this deck is actively bad and, like, it's putting in work. So let's talk about Collected Company. So this card, in the three events this weekend, put up some points. Their finishes were best one of an affinity. Their finishes were a 2-point finish, a 1-point finish, a 1-point finish, a 2-point finish, a 2-point finish, a 1-point finish, a 1-point finish, a 1-point finish, a 1-point finish, and 3-point finish. So like it had one person in top 8 total in three events, and it had a lot of people in top 32.
Yeah, I think we're talking about the Abzan counter
the Devoted Druid. Yeah, the Devoted Druid deck. But I will say this deck's Collected Companies are really good compared to like other Collected Company decks' Collected Companies.
You actually think so? My biggest frustration with this deck is that the Collected Companies specifically are awful.
Interesting. Did you see the Nightfall versions of this deck?
Yeah.
No, I think those Collected Companies looked sweet.
So yeah, if you're playing the Nightfall version, maybe, but I think most people were playing the Abzan version. And I know, having played a pretty good amount with it, my biggest issue was that it felt like I could literally never win a game where I didn't make infinite mana.
Yeah, so I actually put them together in the power rankings this week. The reason is because it's like, I think that if it shifts towards the Nightfall version, then it's just going to be that deck, right? Like, which is, in my opinion, a natural evolution, because in my experience, Abzan Company has just been a bad deck since it was started. It saw a lot of play because people had the cards that they had for Birthing Pod, right? And like, so they had the cards lying around, so it saw a lot of play. It did well at some events because it was played in masses. The thing about this deck is it is faster, easier to combo off, but not nearly as like good in the backup plans. However, the Nightfall version might actually fix that.
Yeah, I actually really liked Martin Yuza's list, which was basically elves with a couple of Duskwatch recruiters, devoted druids, and then one vizier.
Oh, that's awesome.
With the idea being that devoted druid is actually an elf. So if you have a devoted druid that isn't summoning sick and can start this, you can actually just draw your whole deck, play Azuri, and make it infinitely big and then kill them with it.
Yeah, is that what Martin Mueller played?
No, Martin Yuza. So he finished top 16 in Copenhagen. Okay. I think Mueller played Storm.
I think that 4-point finish is from Mueller, so Martin Mueller. So I think Collected Company is one of those cards that it has a real deck building cost. But honestly, if people figure it out, it will probably be a really powerful deck in Modern.
It's one of those cards where it's just like it's kind of a built-in 2-for-1. Right, like right. You, there's a deck building cost, but there's not a cost to how you play it in the game. You just cast it.
Right.
It's almost always a 2-for-1, and sometimes it's your opponent is literally dead on board from basically nothing.
Right.
So, I mean, if you're looking for a powerful card, there's some cost to playing, and it's not free, but.
Yeah. Yep. You know. I think that the card just is putting in work right now and making a deck that I thought was bad probably a lot better. With some new additions, but like it's this deck is shifting closer and closer to something that I believe is playable, which I really didn't like the Abzan Company decks before, and I'm starting to like them now. I know that you and Matt were talking about them on Wednesday and you guys didn't like them, but I really like seeing like them taking two strategies like Nightfall and Company, kind of putting them together a little bit and saying like, okay,
This is a real thing we can be doing. I'm way more interested in the Nightfall and the Elves version than the Abzan version.
So we're going to give out Collected Company to Randon. So Randon, if you'll shoot me a message on Facebook, we'll send you some Collected Company. So, all right, let's move on to our next segment. So every week on the show, we want to talk about the decks that are doing well in a given format. This weekend, there were 3 Modern events. There were 2 GPs and an SEG Open. And we want to talk about the decks that did well at those events. So we don't, on this show, we don't just talk about the decks the top 8 did. We actually break it down all the way into the top 32. So we give 1 point for a top 32, 2 points for a top 16, 3 points for a top 8, 4 points for a top 4, 5 for second, and 6 for first. So coming in with 14 points is your literal least favorite deck in Magic, Eldrazi Tron. Why don't you talk about this really quick, Michael?
Well, if you hate yourself and you hate colors, and you hate fun, Eldrazi Tron is the deck for you. No, seriously, I imagine this deck is pretty good against Death Shadow. That is its biggest draw, in my opinion. It's kind of like Ban Eldrazi. You have the potential for some like more explosive openings, and you also just go a little bit bigger. You're playing a bunch of the Eldrazi. As the game wears on, like in any kind of grindy fair matchup, you just have a huge amount of like 5 and 6 and 7 drops in your deck.
It seems like a lot of the Eldrazi players have Eldrazi players specifically have moved towards this deck. Does it have similar play patterns? It seems like if you don't have map, like it's just a lot different.
It's way more of like a, it's just a bigger deck. I mean, Bant Eldrazi is much more of a Thought Not Seer specifically deck. I feel like this deck is way more of like a, if we're, you know, playing creatures and you're playing Tarmogoyf and I'm playing like Endbringer, kind of dominating you, right? Like if we're both just like casting dudes, this deck is going to cast bigger dudes against literally every deck. So you still have some potential for kind of explosive draws, but I actually think Noble Hierarch opens up a lot more of the explosive draws than Tron lands do, because it's so hard.
What kind of explosive you want, right? Like if you want to be carning people or if you want to be, you know, thought nutting people, they're just different things.
Yeah, my experience has been that this deck isn't really a very good carn deck.
No, it's not.
It's just you need to draw specifically 2 pieces plus Expedition Map. That's the only way it can happen.
So why specifically play this deck then?
You know, this is actually one that I'm a little perplexed at the continued, at least sort of, success of. But I think that, like, being really good against... I think this is a deck people play badly against a lot. I think like people board in Blood Moons against this deck with some kind of frequency, and you're playing like a bunch of Mind Stones and some basic Wastes and Ghost Quarters to get, like, I think this is a deck that is sort of hard to position yourself against. I also think if you're just like running well or playing it extremely well, it's just kind of hard to interact with in a lot of ways. And if you're seeing the kind of matchups where they can't punish you for being a little bit clunky, you are just a meat grinder in the end game. Like, you're just
sure
your turn, you know, 5, 6, 7 are like, I'm gonna play a 5-drop, a 6-drop, and a 7-drop, or sometimes a 6, a 7, and an 8, like every single turn as long as this game goes.
Okay. Yeah, I can honestly say I don't think so. I try and play Modern every single week, and I don't think I've ever played against this deck. And I've never played with it. And that is something that I'll probably have to fix before our next Modern event. Because all my friends tell me this deck is really bad. So I just haven't... I don't have an opinion. I don't know what to say.
It's like, it's done pretty well, like, the last few months on Magic Online. That's, you know,
maybe,
most of its
success. Maybe I did. I might have actually played some matches with this.
It is okay. I think it's just more of a metagame deck than something.
I think when it first came out, I tried this.
I mean, if Chalice is really good for some reason, I think this deck is totally acceptable.
Did this deck ever play black?
What spell specifically?
Like Collected Brutality?
I don't think so.
Hmm.
It's been basically straight colorless.
Okay. I don't think I've played this deck. I know I have never played against it. So I will defer to you then. Let's go on to our next deck. Let's go on to a deck that I have played quite a bit of, and that is Titan Shift. So Titan Shift is it's what it sounds like. It's Primeval Titan, yep. Scape Shift. Two of my literal favorite Magic cards ever printed. This deck is really fast, really powerful, and you shouldn't be playing Explore.
Well, I would actually say this deck is really slow and really powerful. Like,
it's not slow.
It has a lot of... It can't turn three without...
Well, that's true.
Okay, so you're a straight combo deck that can't really turn three.
You're not a combo deck, you're a ramp deck.
Yeah, it's unusual. It's like, it's slow, but it's also really good against Thoughtseize. You're pretty consistent at turn fouring, generally. It's a funny deck. It's like, if you were playing in a metagame where... I think like this deck probably got helped out by Anger of the Gods being good this week. Like, I think Anger of the Gods is pretty good against all these company decks.
Yeah.
But if you're playing in a metagame where Anger of the Gods is good, it looks like the most successful is from... It looks like the Teemu Halonen's list was playing Lightning Bolts in the main deck, but Anger's in the board.
There were some that were playing Angers and the new one that cycles.
Oh, Sweltering Suns?
Yes.
That's interesting. Actually, Sweltering Suns is kind of cute. But this deck is like, it is good at going big. Like, if your opponent's plan is to Thoughtseize you out of the game, they have to Thoughtseize you out of the game and also kill you really fast, because he's playing like 4 Titans, 4 Scapeshifts, and 2 Summoner's Pacts, and everything else gets lands.
Yeah, he's got a Chandra in there. Like, there's just a lot of it in this deck, and that can be a real problem for a lot of decks. One of the things that I really like about this deck is how much it can have. It is very easy for you to get Thought-Knots here, and then you kill them the next turn.
Oh, yeah. Thought-Knots here, and like, so Thoughtseize, just because of the density of Thoughtseize effects the Death Shadow decks are playing, that can sometimes be an issue. But.
Yeah, I agree.
But like, Thought-Knots here, or like counter spells, you're just kind of like, whatever.
Yeah,
like, I'm going to have something, right? You have to take literally every single bomb. Like, they're,
yeah, one thing that I would recommend to people is if they have a ramp light hand, you're definitely supposed to be taking their ramp spells over their threats.
Yeah, one of the ways you can get this deck is just that they actually, like, so in Halonen's deck specifically, only Colony Heart Expedition can actually generate more than one, only Colony Heart Expedition, I guess Chandra, can actually generate more than one mana from one card. Everything else is one card for one mana. So there are plenty of hands where if you Thoughtseize them, or like if you lead on Inquisition and hit their first ramp piece, Thoughtseize should actually take their second ramp piece over.
Right. Yep. Like I completely agree.
Like, what you want to do is not give them live top decks, because if you put them in a spot where they have like three draws to hit something, they have like 10 plus outs that just kill you on the spot.
Right. Which is a real problem, because even if that Primeval Titan doesn't kill you, it makes all of the rest of the spells in their deck kill you.
Right. Right. I mean, they might have, like, I've seen people before, like, get uncracked fetches. Like, they'll get uncracked fetches at some point in the game because they start flooding out a lot. And then you hit a Titan that gets, like, two more Valakuts to supplement the one you already drew. And all of a sudden, those fetches are nine
damage. 9 points. Yeah, they're 9 points of damage.
It's very much the kind of deck where it's a little slower than some of the other pure combo decks, but you're a lot better against Thoughtseize, and just attrition strategies in general are, like, really underwhelming against you.
The next deck we have on our power rankings coming up next is the Brian DeCandio, I want to call it Court of Calling deck.
Yeah, Court is actually, like, a lot better in this one than Company, in my opinion.
Why is that?
Well, two reasons. One, you're trying to assemble a two-card combo. But second of all, the interaction between Devoted Druid and Court of Calling is a lot like Wall of Roots, since you can, like, tap it and then untap it by putting a counter on it. And because Vizier prevents the counter from ever going on it, it can be a negative 1/1 when you get the Vizier and you can still make infinite mana. So generally, Devoted Druid on 2 into land on 3 actually is infinite mana with a Cord.
Yeah, it is something that when watching it on coverage, I've just been like they will kill you really quick. Like,
oh yeah. Oh no, you could, like, a ton of your mold of 5s or even 4 if you just, like, land Devoted Druid, you know, like, there are a huge number of outs to just kill your opponent instantly, and that's kind of sweet.
So which version of this deck is, like, the best version right now, in your opinion?
I haven't played a lot with the Nightfall versions. I don't think the Abzan one is very good. I don't know if you agree with that.
I have not played Modern recently. Okay. Other than, like, I play Grixis Shadow and Titan and Scapeshift decks every Tuesday. Like, I'll just play them. And I haven't, this deck is only 2 weeks old, so I just haven't
played much against it. I would not recommend the Abzan version. I think specifically both Brennan DeCandio and I think Brad Carpenter is one of his buddies who played this same list the week before. They are both very, very good players. And I'm sure I know Brennan streamed this deck a bunch this last week, and getting to talk to Brad about it probably helped a bunch too. But I do not think this list is very good. At least that's been my experience. If I was going to start, I would start with either the Elves Shell or the Nightfall Shell, depending on what was more appealing to you. I haven't had a chance to play a huge volume of games with either, but I think those shells are going to be a little bit better. I think one of the appealing things about this thing, about this in particular, about this specific combo, is that it is actually a two-card combo. And really, if you're going to play Court of Calling in the deck anyways, just, like, in Elves, right, you're playing Court of Calling already. You're already playing Collected Company. Devoted Druid is, like, a fine mana dork. I think Yuza was playing one Vizier, so the cost of playing this as an infinite combo is actually just, like, a couple of Duskwatch Recruiters.
Yeah, that is a really interesting way to go about this. And the question is how much does it make your deck faster? Does it make your deck better? Like, what does it actually do, like, for your given matchups when you're playing Elves, right?
Yeah, I haven't played enough Elves or enough of this deck, frankly, to know. My impression was that this Abzan version was fairly beatable. You're a lot softer to just, like, spot removal than traditional Abzan Company lists have been. And I would think that Nightfall would rectify a lot of the problems with that as well, right? Because you have, like, a real plan of, like, if they're, like, going to Fatal Push your Devoted Druid and then your Knight of the Reliquary doesn't die, like, they can just, like, get attacked to death.
Yeah, and I think that it's important to note that, like, there are now, you know, a lot more lightning bolts running around in the form of Fatal Push, right? So, like, there's double the lightning bolts that there used to be. So having your deck be worse against that card is a little bit rough.
Right. And that's sort of the appeal of elves to me too, in that I don't believe that spot removal one for one is a like a real way to beat that deck.
Sure.
Right. So, and I would imagine the same thing with Nightfall. Just that, like, if they're going to tax their spot removal really heavily, your spell quellers get better, your Knight of Reliquaries get better. Everything else is improved by the presence of this mana dork that they have to kill, or you're just representing killing them.
And if you think about it, it kind of falls in the same vein as the elves things that you like, right? Where it's like, I was already going to be playing Collected Companies.
Right.
So, and I can just jam these combos into my deck and then have, you know, more infinite combos. Kind of similar to the Domri Raid Kiki Core decks of old, before Jeff Hooligan got his hands on them. Right?
Yeah. Yeah. I can totally believe that. There's some version of this combo that is powerful. A two-card combo that makes infinite mana on turn three with, like, very little help is powerful.
Right.
That it's definitely powerful. It's just a matter of finding sort of what shell it fits best into. And it might even just be for a given tournament or a given week.
Yeah. Coming up next, we have your favoritest deck.
I do love this one, and that is Dredge.
I'll let you go on this. I plan on buying this on Modo and stuff like that, but I just haven't played a lot with this. I played against this deck a ton. I have not played a lot with it though.
Yeah, it's very good. It had 23 points this week, so finishing in second place. And there are a number of different ways you can build it, but you're basically locked into about, you know, 55, 56 cards in the main deck.
What do you think? Well, this is actually our deck of the week. Should we just move on and come back?
Yeah. Absolutely.
Let's do that. Let's go on to our number one deck. We have coming in. This is honestly, I thought this is the best deck in Modern for like 2 months. Is this kind of where you're at as the best deck in Modern right now?
Well, I really like this deck's matchup against Dredge.
This deck being Grixis Shadow for those who are listening and don't have access to the screen. Coming in, I think 26 points.
Yes, I believe that's the right number. I think this deck is a lot harder to play than Jund's Shadow.
It's true, it is.
You have a lot more options for better or worse, you know, sometimes definitely for worse. Like, we've all been there where you just have too many options available to you and you kind of overthink it and blow it. But this deck just, like, it gets to play kind of it gets to a lot of the things that the Jund deck does, in that you can sometimes play a game plan centered around a lot of just Tarmogoyf effects, but you get to cut a lot of... I think your filler is just more complimentary.
Yeah, I have a few thoughts. The first one is this deck kind of, to me, is the better version of Grixis Delver. A lot of players did really, really well with Grixis Delver a lot, and I always felt that the deck was kind of lacking, and this deck really isn't. This deck really can do it all.
It's just more flexible, right? It's like Grixis Delver, except sometimes you kill them on turn three.
Yeah, it's as though your Delvers get to just be giant, right? I don't have to attack you seven times. I get to attack you three times. And I mean, that's just way better in a tempo deck.
Yeah, sometimes not even three. Like, I mean, this deck can really, really clock an opponent. One of the things, looking at the Brad Nelson list specifically, one of the things I really like about this deck, about this version of the deck, is that he's playing very close to just straight blue-black. One of my biggest qualms with this deck before, like, Snap Bolt is really powerful, but it's really hard on your mana to play like Death Shadow, Stubborn Denial. Like, you need to be able to cast your cantrips early.
Yeah.
And it's really hard on your mana to keep having to fetch like Steam Vents, and then you want double black. I feel like he's really streamlined. Like, the fetch hierarchy with this deck, where the red is turn two for two Terminates or turn three for two Quilligan's Commands. I mean, I guess it's a single Lightning Bolt, but my fetch hierarchy with this deck seems much more simple.
Yeah, I also liked that he cut down on the number of Lightning Bolts for similar reasons. I do still wish that I had two of them. But, I mean, what are you going to cut, right? It's kind of semantics at that point, but I do really agree with you and like the direction this is headed.
Yeah, it looks like he's built it to be a little more of like a kind of a pure, it seems stupid to say pure control deck, but it's like a control deck where sometimes you just draw a couple of Death Shadows and now you can really flip the script on like your big mana opponents.
It kind of reminds me of Team America in Legacy.
Yeah, I can see that. Like, so, you sometimes just play a bunch of big threats that your opponent can't really handle. Sometimes you play a tempo game, and sometimes you can really slow the game down with Hymn to Turok or whatever. And here, sometimes you just kind of have, like, Thoughtseize, Stubborn Nile, Tasigur. You can kind of play Grixis Control.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like this deck a lot. Let's go on to our deck of the week. So this week, our deck of the week, because we have this guy that loves Dredge more than, you know, he loves his girlfriend, we have... You know, wow. Michael Hendry. Probably not. That's probably not true.
You know, it seemed a little unfair.
I do not mean that. I'm sorry if you're listening, Ian. let's talk about Dredge. So you actually asked for 40 card Friedman's version.
Yeah, I really like, so most people are not playing, the main difference in Friedman's version, I'm not actually a huge fan of his Ghost Quarter, which is very atypical, but I love Four Collective Brutalities Bane deck. So for those, he's basically trimmed, it looks like a Golgari Thug, and then he is sort of combined all the other flex slots, so like... Remy LeFrancois is playing Insolent Neonates, which I have always found to be pretty underwhelming.
Yeah.
And Friedman is
playing... They're good with Grave Troll, I found, but like ever since Grave Troll got banned, I felt like they've been worse.
Yeah, against the deck. The idea being your game ones are mostly so good anyways, because it's really just tough to interact with you that you don't need absolute maximum speed, and Neonate is your worst enabler. Collective Brutality is mostly as good as enabler. And also, I like how Collective Brutality sits right now. If we expect to play against a lot of Devoted Druids and Collected Companies, Collective Brutality is outstanding.
Yeah. What are the key cards that you like, you mentioned earlier, that you just can't cut in this deck, that like you have to play?
Okay, so you're definitely playing 4 Bloodghasts, 4 Prized Amalgams, 4 Narcomoebas, 4 Stinkweed Imps, 4 Faithless Lootings, 4 Cathartic Reunions, 4 Life from the Loams, and probably at least 2, but realistically 3 Conflagrates.
Okay.
Those are sort of the... And then mana base, there's a little bit of debate. It looks like most people have moved to a combination Fastland, Fetchland mana base, which makes sense to me. But... Some people prefer more fetches. Some people prefer more fast lands or rainbow lands.
Where do you sit?
I think I like the combinations. I would probably lean a little bit heavier on fetches. I would love to cut the Ghost Quarter in this list for another fetch land.
Yeah. Since we last talked about this deck, it looks like Vengeful Pharaoh has moved to the board from the main. Where do you like this card? What is the reason that it's showing up in so many lists all the time?
So this card is great against really a lot of it. It's solid against a lot of decks. I mean, really any deck where you're getting attacked, it's at least okay. But the real reason that this card has seen play traditionally is to protect you from Teemer Battle Rage. And that is because if your opponent Teemer Battle Rage is a Death Shadow, it will get double strike. So when it deals its first strike damage, you can use Vengeful Pharaoh to kill it, and they don't get the second one. So that has traditionally been the main use of Vengeful Pharaoh.
I like it.
Yeah, it's very elegant.
I love Magic. That is like, it's like, man, you know what we keep losing to? This. Well, how do we beat it? Do we play removal? No, like, what's the best removal we can put in our graveyard? Nothing. There's no removal in our graveyard. Well, yeah. Like, how are we losing? Well, we lose because they battle rage it and we die too fast. Okay. Yeah. Well, like, let's put in Vengeful Pharaoh then. Like, that's just great. I appreciate that.
Yeah, so what it does is it actually is very... They need multiple battle... You're very good at chump blocking, so it's difficult, like, between Narcomoeba and Prized Amalgam and Stinkweed Imp and all this different stuff. And you're also fairly good at, you know, putting a definite end game... Like, they can't sit back forever. So it's very nice in that it forces them to, like, battle rage you on consecutive turns to get through it. It's very difficult for them to beat.
One thing that we have here, which we really liked during Infect's time, is Dark Blast. Or, sorry, not Dark Blast. What is this card called?
Which one?
The dredge is it dredge 2/1 black, give a creature -1/-1?
Dark Blast, yeah. So
oh, it is Dark Blast. Okay.
Very good against Infect. It's probably good against all these company decks popping up again. If people are
That's actually what I was gonna ask. Is that what it's for now?
Well, it's so it can kill Vizier of Remedies if they play it out first. It can also kill Noble Hierarchs. It's also insane against Affinity.
Yeah.
It's a card where if you're playing decks that have targets, it is a great dredger in that, much like Life from the Loam, it's kind of self-sufficient, right? It doesn't need, you don't need to discard it to get it going. You can just actually play it and it goes straight
you
to your
cast it.
Yeah. So two in the main deck is more than we've typically seen, but I think it shows that this weekend, Friedman was very focused on beating company.
What are your good matchups with this deck?
I would imagine with this build in particular, you were quite good against company. You're good against any of the, really, any of the fair decks. You're good against, like, Eldrazi Tron. You're good against, you're pretty good against Jund Death Shadow. I think you're generally favored against Tron in general.
Okay. And what are your bad matchups?
Titan Shift is not terrible, but it's not great. It depends on how many angers they're playing. It's a lot better for you, but you don't usually have the luxury of always. If they're playing bolts, it's better because they can't wipe your board. If they're playing angers, it's tougher.
But aren't most of them playing a mix anyway?
Well, but it depends too on, like, if you win game one, you're a lot more likely to not have. There's a high chance that if you play multiple sideboard games, you're going to run into hate that you can't beat somewhere. It's very important to win game ones with this deck.
Oh, so because that deck typically plays anger, that's what makes it the bad matchup.
It makes it worse. They're also just fast enough that you don't really have the choice. You pretty much have to go all in every time. This matchup is where playing more fetch lands helps you a lot. And that's because you can get back a single Bloodghast in their second main, and then all your prized amalgams will return in their end step. Mm-hmm. So sometimes you can even do something like having multiple Bloodghasts, multiple prized amalgams, get one Bloodghast in their second main, return all your amalgams end step, conflagrate them to get them under 10, hit another land drop, return the rest of your Bloodghasts and kill them.
Okay.
So there are some really interesting lines of play in that matchup, and it's not horrible, but it's not great. Grixis Death Shadow looks like a matchup that is not good. Traditionally, Snap Surgical has been a problem. This deck just also has a lot of cheap counter magic mixed with a lot of cheap discard. Like Brad Nelson in particular is playing Snapcasters with Surgicals and Nihil Spellbombs in the board.
So how bad is it for you to get your Cathartic Reunion countered?
It depends on what the rest of the texture of their hand looks like, right? Like, if they can counter a Cathartic Reunion, but then their win condition, you know, they're playing, like, Blue Moon or something, and their win condition is to eventually get you with Snapcaster Mages or Torrential Gearhulk, it's not that bad. Like, you still discard the cards, you can play a slower game, you can keep dredging back Stinkweed Imp, returning your Bloodghasts very conservatively, conflagrate them a little bit here and there, and you'd be shocked at the amount of games you can win like that. Now, when they're playing Grixis Death Shadow, that kind of game plan is very hard to win with.
Awesome. Okay. I think we've covered a lot now. Like,
yeah, I hope that's helpful. I'm happy to answer more questions if anyone has them, but
I learned some stuff. I've never played with dredge. It's a deck that I've been wanting to try. I just haven't yet. And most of my experience with it is actually with Titan Shift. So I was interested by your Lightning Bolt comment, because I usually play like either 3 to 4 Lightning Bolts and always 2 Angers in the main.
Yeah.
And I've never lost a dredge in a tournament that I can think of.
So again, more collective brutalities would help the dredge player in that matchup.
Yeah, I would assume so. The other deck that I played against it with is just Rug Scapeshift, and it's actually an actively good matchup for me in that world.
Sure. I also think dredge is quite difficult to play.
Yes.
It kind of falls into the infect category, where the easy games are so mindless that people think that every game looks like that. But I actually think Dredge is incredibly difficult to play.
I find that people, we need to do this podcast one day, because there is weird misconceptions. People don't like it when you say that their archetype is easy or hard. And they are like, well, Magic's just hard and everything's contextual. And here's the thing, is that when you play a deck like Dredge or like Mono White Aggro, people think that your games, because they're linear, are easier. But they're actually making all of the same decisions that you're making. You're just taking them for granted. So, for example, they still have to decide whether or not you have a counterspell, when just as much as you have to decide whether to counter a spell, right? People think that, like, oh, like, you just jam your things. That's not true. Like, you have to play around your opponent's cards when you're playing a linear deck. Otherwise, you're going to miss sequence, and that's how you lose with linear decks.
Right. It's also true that, like, while Dredge, often the game ones are easy, you pay a big deck building cost for it. Like, there's such a big deck building cost to playing Dredge that your sideboard games are always very, very difficult.
Yep.
I just think in general, Dredge can be a frustrating deck to lose to, in that if you're not prepared and you're not playing cards like Anger of the Gods for other reasons, you almost can't beat it. But the matches that are difficult, often you play a lot of very close games where deciding whether or not to attack, with how much, how you play your conflagrates, how you, you know, all these little things, how you fetch, how, whether you should be fetch shocking or fetching basics or playing fast lands. Like, there are just so many little things, and in a lot of the games, every single decision matters.
Yep. Let's move on to our next segment, because I think this kind of ties into it a little bit. Let's talk about our training arcs this week. We wanted to talk about understanding why you lost. And this is something that I think a lot of Magic players struggle with, and once they struggle with it, they start making excuses. So the first step and the first thing that we kind of have to cover, Michael, is just accepting that things are within your control. Why don't you talk about that a little bit?
So I think it just, when you're reflecting on why you lost a match or whatever, you first start with the things that like actually were choices. I think it's a lot more productive if we start from the frame of, okay, so what choices did I make in this match? Which of them were good ones? Which of them were bad ones? Why did I think this was, you know, what worked out well for me? What didn't work out, right? There's a lot of things, even in a match of Magic where you are either playing against a bad matchup or you mulligan a lot of the time you still had relevant decisions. It's very, very rare to play a match of Magic where you did not make a single impactful decision.
I completely agree. And it's also rare that even if it was, like, even if you played your first two rounds and you felt like you didn't make an impactful decision, the deck that you brought to the tournament, the 75 you brought, the what you, like, what time you went
how
to
you,
bed.
Yeah, how you built your sealed pool, whatever, yes. Right? Like,
anything like that really does have an impact on whether or not you win matches of Magic. So I just don't believe that there's often a time where things were completely out of control. There can be matches where that's true, right? Like, I can sit down and say I was correct. Like, so we'll take this PPTQ that I kind of talked about earlier in the show, for example, right? I can say that it was absolutely correct for me not to prepare for the Dovin Bond, Jace, Sphinx of the Final Word, Gideon, Approach of the Second Sun deck. It was correct for me not to be prepared for it, okay? It was a bad matchup for me. It could have been a great matchup for me if I picked another deck. Do I still think, even though I lost the deck round one, that I played the right deck in this tournament? I do. I do think that. Do I think that I played perfectly in that match? Nope. No, I don't. I was upset. I felt like there was nothing I could have done, and I played worse because of it. And because of that, I probably can't look back and actually say if I made a mistake. And that's a problem. Like, that's something that I need to fix.
So I had an experience sort of mirroring that a little bit in reverse on Sunday. So I was playing Legacy, and I was playing Stoneblade against LED Dredge. And I had Rest in Pieces, but had forgotten to actually put them in my sideboard. And I wasn't playing any Surgical Extractions because I had intended to play Rest in Pieces, but then I got confused and, you know, just left somewhere else. So I'm playing a deck with exactly zero graveyard hate, and despite losing game one, actually managed to win both games two and three without drawing a single hate card. And while I was obviously extremely lucky to win those games, I think I was probably less than 10% in both games, I still felt like I made decisions that maximized my potential to win, right? If I'd played them badly, I definitely couldn't have won. So
exactly.
It kind of goes both ways.
And the thing is like, yeah, I'm at a disadvantage here, but like, why am I not going to just put everything that I have into this to try and win still?
Yeah, and it was, I had a really interesting interaction with my opponent where he was like, oh, sorry, I'm sure this isn't the matchup you wanted to play. And I had to kind of stop him and go, oh, no, I mean, you know, obviously this isn't the matchup I would choose to play, but I actually, you can get kind of wrapped up and get really interested in like, okay, so I still know what's in my deck. I basically know what's in your deck. How can I play to give myself the highest percentage?
You know what's funny? This topic, do you know what this topic was originally called?
What?
I just didn't feel like it would get as many like listens or views if I called it this. The idea for the topic was actually you either win or you learn. Like those are the two options that you have in a game of Magic if you want to get better. And I think that what we just spoke of kind of encapsulates that, right? Like you either win your match or you learn. And I'm not saying that you don't learn when you win. I'm just saying that you don't really lose. Like if you are process oriented and do what you can, you will just win more matches of Magic. And if you take that process all the time, you're not really losing, right? You're just gaining more knowledge.
Right. So just like you're saying, even if you're playing an abysmal matchup, I think still continuing to stay in the moment, still continuing to think, okay, so I know this matchup is terrible, but what does a game look like if I'm winning it? Right? How can I try to steer the game in this direction? Like, I think that at least being able to come up with a sequence in your head that creates a game state that you could win from, I think that's really valuable, even if you're getting run over. Yeah. Like, because, you know, you say, oh, well, he's just going to play Sphinx of the Final Word and then I'm dead. But I'm sure you can still come up with ways that you could win a game. They're not easy to come up with, but it's not like you say, oh, well, you have Sphinx of the Final Word and you're 75. I just can't win.
Oh my gosh. No, we literally walked away from the table and I was talking to Danny and he was like, yeah, you couldn't win that matchup. And like, in my head, I'm like, no, it's probably like a 92% in his favor matchup. Sure, like I am less than 10%. And the thing is then Danny's like, yeah, I don't know how you win that game other than like, maybe like double Anger of the Gods in hand or whatever the card is called. Sweltering Suns. And I literally thought to myself, I can't believe I boarded out Sweltering Suns.
Right. You're like, oh, that would have been, yeah.
Like, I literally thought to myself, oh my gosh, I boarded out Sweltering Suns. I boarded in Fumigate as a one of, but I boarded out Sweltering Suns. I probably shouldn't have done that. Because worst comes to worst, I can still cycle in that matchup pretty easily. Like, it was just wrong, right? And so, even though I was at a huge disadvantage, I still learned something and learned that I can't – go ahead.
You're at a huge disadvantage, but you're obviously at a way bigger disadvantage if you just don't play to lines that can win a game, right?
No, exactly. Let's talk about the next thing on here, which is looking at the process. So when you are – I'm trying to understand why you lost. I think that part of that has to be looking at your process for how you ended up where you ended up. Why don't you talk about that a little bit?
I like starting even before the match. Like one of the things I have to remind myself of – especially like I really like Dredge in Modern, so I've played it kind of a bunch of times. And one of the things that is going to happen when you play Dredge is you're going to, like, if you play it in the GP, you are eventually going to play that guy. And that guy is going to have main deck Scavenging Ooze, sideboard Rest in Peace, and Leyline of the Void in a Surgical Extraction. And he's going to draw all of it, and you are going to get bent over. Like, it's just, it's not going to be pretty, and you're going to feel like, oh, I'm so unlucky to have played against this guy. But you know, think about how many other people you played against who, you know, maybe felt the same because you're playing Dredge, right? It kind of goes both ways. And when you're playing decks that have polarized matchups, that's part of it. So sometimes you think, okay, I literally could not have won game two or three. Like, I won game one by playing well or whatever, but there was, you know, he kept seven with Leyline, Rest in Peace, and a Scavenging Ooze in game two and three. I can't beat that. That's fine. So if I can't beat it in gameplay, because we're taking a really extreme example, obviously, So is Dredge still a correct choice if this is something I expect to play? It's like, how do I look at my testing process? How do I look at my deck selection process? You know, how do I manage my, well, like what you were talking about earlier with your always improving moment, how do I manage my emotions, stay level, and kind of remain focused on thinking about the event, the match, my deck, rather than getting upset that I was so unlucky?
Yeah, so it's so funny. So I'm going to use Danny as an example on this. So Danny went to his first Pro Tour. He picked a deck, and he just jam, showed up at the tournament with probably one of the worst decks in the room for the tournament. Like, he'll probably tell you that. I don't think it was that bad, but, like, it was pretty bad. He played Blue-Black Zombies at Pro Tour Elderspoon, and he lost a win-in for Top 8 at his first Pro Tour, right? So his second Pro Tour, we do a ton of testing. We get into a house for, I mean, I think we got into houses for, like, 3 days. Like, we were basically in a house for a week testing for Pro Tour Kaladesh, right? And we did team meetings and, like, basically copied what a lot of the super teams did. And ended up on two different decks were played, right? So there was a Teemer Marvel deck that was built to hardcast Ulamog and Emrakul. And then there was a Teemer Emerge deck that Casey played saying, I don't think other people are going to end up playing this Marvel deck. I can't beat it anyway. I'm going to play this deck. And Marvel ended up being the best deck at the tournament. You all day two'd. And afterwards, Danny said, I did this wrong. I should have done what I did with the other one and just picked a deck and just jammed it a bunch. Since then, Danny has said, I did it right that time. I got lucky the first time. What in the world is happening? What is Danny right? Which was the correct thing for Danny to do, Michael?
I feel like it's just about separating results from how it went. So, like, I talked to Danny a bunch about Eldritch Moon, and first of all, he did very well in Limited. I think he 5-1 Limited there, and I think he 3-3 Limited at Kaladesh. So right off the bat, you're now needing a home run in Constructed to really be in the same situation. In terms of matchups, I don't think his Zombies deck was okay. That was, like, sort of a deck in that format at times. But I think
that's
he played against
great things to say about a deck you chose to take to a Pro Tour.
Well, I mean, it's always kind of like that, right? You hope that the deck is good, but especially if you're trying to play metagame decks of sorts, it's just how it's going to work.
You know what? I want to be clear. I am not talking trash on Danny, because I think Danny's an amazing Magic player.
No,
and Vair Pariah was like gasoline for him at that Pro Tour.
But
what I'm saying here is which process is the correct process, or is there a correct process, or do you need what's going on here?
Well, I think basically I know he had also said that he played Bant Spirits like multiple times at that Pro Tour, and that deck could not beat Liliana the Last Hope because it, you know, was +1 destroy target creature. But a lot of it is like you have to separate results a little bit from your thinking, right? Because things can go really well for all kinds of reasons. Just like you could have great drafts where, I mean, I think my first draft at PT Kaladesh, the first opponent I played had Heart of Kirin Smuggler's Copter, or rather Sky Sovereign Smuggler's Copter. And, you know, his deck was obviously great, but did that come from his Limited prep? Or did that come from literally he could have played 38 other cards and it almost didn't matter as long as he drew one in any game? Right. So you have to separate results from your preparation a little bit. And I think that this kind of goes into separating, like in this same situation, separating what's happening to you in matches of Magic from how you prepared for them and understanding why this is happening, not just saying, oh, well, I went 11-4 this time and I, you know, went 12-3 last time, so therefore last time I was better. Right? There's just too much variance involved in Magic for that to be a valid way to.
Let's talk about this. Let's actually dive into this. Because I am willing to be wrong on this. You guys took this deck to the Pro Tour, right? It was this Hedron Archive, Drowner of Hope, Ulamog, Chandra Marvel deck, right? And I think, if I'm not mistaken, Danny had a winning record with it and you did not, right?
No, I think I had a winning record with it and Danny did not.
Oh, is that what it was? Okay.
Yeah, I think we had maybe, my memory is that we hadn't played against very good versions of vehicles and there were a lot more selfless spirits than we anticipated.
Yes, that was true for Casey too, by the way.
Yeah, I remember Casey playing a bunch of Aether Meltdowns and being very unhappy with them. But they were kind of needed in that deck to tie the mana together. Anyways, that was kind of my memory of that event, that like our deck was actually, it was okay for Constructed. It had some really bad matchups, but it was okay.
So I took your guys' deck, changed the sideboard, and played it at States the next weekend and won States with it. And so like my memory of the deck is very fond, right? Like when I think about that deck, I was like, we did all this Pro Tour prep. I used that Pro Tour prep to win States. Because I prepared like a Pro Tour, I won States, similar to why I won States the first time I won States. So for me, like the preparation that we did directly correlated with me winning States. But like for you guys, the preparation you did might have directly correlated with you not qualifying for another Pro Tour. Like what, how do you feel about this?
I feel like ultimately just, you have to like, you have to be willing to just stand by your preparation in some senses. Like preparation doesn't get better or worse in terms of process because of how well or poorly you did. Right. I think sometimes it's easier to reflect critically on preparation when you did poorly, but yeah. It's also true that your preparation typically just wasn't as good if you're consistently doing poorly. Right. I mean, it's kind of a chicken and egg situation.
I think you actually specifically highlighted what was wrong with the preparation at that Pro Tour. And I actually think we haven't tried to fix it since then because we haven't had that as many people qualified. But we specifically said, we had a big team meeting after that Pro Tour, and we're like, what did we do wrong? And what did we do right? The thing we did right, we got a bunch of people together, and we ended up with like a really decent version, like in my opinion, a better version of that deck for that tournament than the all-in combo version that people ended up playing.
And I mean, ours was still pretty all-in, but I agree that it was like a better deck list than what Sam Black, Matt Nass, all those guys played. So,
yep. And but what we didn't do correctly is the thing that you just highlighted. We didn't play against good Mardu decks.
Mardu actually wasn't a deck at that point. That was red-white. But
that's true.
But remember, because we saw it on the SCG, and the list was really weird and playing like a bunch of main deck Sky Sovereigns, and just no one liked it when we played some games with it.
Oh my gosh, I forgot. That deck was so bad.
Yeah, it was really clunky, and then people trimmed it down and made it look... It was like it was the like the red-white dwarves deck, basically.
I literally forgot that people did like videos and all this stuff on red-white vehicles. I think it might be our most viewed YouTube video ever is literally me punching the crap out of Matt Kling while he's playing that deck.
Yeah, it's that like the SCG version, it had a lot of good players playing it that week. And I think it did fairly well, mostly because the players were really good. But it was not very well constructed and it got pounded in our testing, and then we didn't fix it correctly. We didn't deck sucks, whatever, we're off it,
right? And that was the thing that in our team meeting we're like, okay, how do we fix this? We're like, oh, we need to build a deck, make it great, and then make other decks great. And you know, I personally have plans for when I next qualify for the Pro Tour, because I believe that the people qualified really lead the testing in our group. And so for me, I plan on doing almost the same thing we did in Kaladesh, and then just assigning people that I believe are good at certain parts of aspects of Magic and improving decks that they believe in, right? Being champions of decks is something that I get, that Paulo tells me that people do in the house, right? And I believe in that. And I think that we're talking about our process, right? This is the thing that we did right and that we did wrong, right? We did great in getting together, refining some number of deck lists, but then we refined them once and then just jammed against them until we found the deck that beat them the most, or the decks that beat them the most, but then we didn't go back to them. And this is one event, right? But the thing is that when you're preparing for a PPTQ, your preparation isn't like this, right? Your preparation is probably leagues on Moto or other PPTQs or like your Tuesday standard event. And so your process has to be a little bit different. So for example, when I play on Wednesday standard events, I will change up my sideboard and main deck and try different combinations to see if I like where cards sit, different card types, different things like that in these high stakes events comparatively to other events that I can play in.
Yeah, I really like that. I do the same thing with leagues a lot, where like I'll just mess around with lists a little bit and run it through a few leagues until I have a feeling for whether or not I like a card and kind of what quantity I'm hoping to draw it. You know, if I change the mana base, can I support this card? Can I like what works? Because then at least you have parameters where if I already like a deck, at least I know, okay, this is a version that makes sense, or this is a version that doesn't make sense. And we can kind of go from there.
Yeah. The other thing that I've started to try and do in my process is giving multiple people my deck list and asking them to try it and play it. So for example, I've been playing a lot of Teemer Marvel with main deck, Elder Deep Fiends, three of them. And both Corey and Casey have now played my deck list and given me feedback on it. Corey didn't like the Elder Deep Fiends as much. He was worried about them getting countered against control. And I was like, oh, that's so weird. Like, why are you worried about that? And then I watched Casey play against control this weekend. He got so unlucky. So Casey had the best tiebreakers going into a round. And because the only round that isn't random is the last round, in the second to last round, he got paired down. He got paired down as the person with the highest tiebreakers to just swap his tiebreakers.
That's so powerful.
It was so bad. And he won. So he wins his match and then drops like five slots.
Yeah, it happens. That's how it goes.
Anyway, so he plays the deck. And then last round, he plays against a control deck. And I watch him playing. And I'm like, why is he not jamming these Deep Fiends? And afterwards, we talk about it. And he's worried about counter spells. And I was like, oh, that's so interesting. I literally don't care if my Elder Deep Fiend gets countered. I used it to get in my next threat in the control matchup to land like a big powerful thing. And he had a Chandra in his hand, and we talked about it a lot. And he came to the conclusion that, we actually came to the conclusion that his first play was correct. Then he should have taken my line and then my line and then my line. One thing that I find important is it's important that you allow others to comment on your play, whether it's your friends or your opponents, because, as smart as I think I am, I'm often wrong. And
yeah, on the flip side, I wouldn't take your friends or opponents' words as gospel, right? Like,
sure.
They often have more information or partially incorrect information or haven't seen everything. So, like, you want other input, but you also don't want to throw yourself under the bus just because someone you respect disagrees with you, right? I mean,
no, that's true. But what I'm saying here is that. So I agree with that. This is important too.
It's finding the fine line, right, between just being needlessly hard on yourself and
I wanna dive deeper in that because I completely agree with you. So for example, I knew that Casey's opponent didn't have multiple counter spells. So I was okay with Casey playing an Elder Deep Fiend, getting it countered, tapping him out, and playing a Chandra. And then playing a Marvel after. Casey was like, okay, I'm going to play the Marvel first, get it countered, and then play Chandra, and then hope to draw enough to Elder Deep Fiend him into Ulamog. What actually was correct was to go, Marvel, take your counter, Deep Fiend, tap you out, Chandra, attack you, you're at three, good luck.
Right.
So our lines together were actually correct after we did a bunch of talking about it. What's important is actually the communication. It's actually talking about it and giving yourself the opportunity to actually improve, whether that's with your friend or with your opponent.
Yeah, I had a really good discussion with a player playing Death and Taxes on Sunday where we disagreed about one of his lines of play. But because he was receptive to what I was saying, I'm not actually sure that I was correct. I think his line may well have been better, but I feel like we both got a chance to learn quite a bit and really flesh out like why exactly this was played the way it was. And I think there's a lot of value in that. Like, just basically, when someone is critiquing you, trying to learn from it and not necessarily taking it as antagonism unless there's a good reason to think it is. I mean, I've certainly played against players who are very critical and kind of antagonistic. And I just want to be clear that that's not what we're talking about. Right. Yeah. I mean, you don't have to sit there and listen to someone who's berating you for some play. Right. I mean, no one deserves to deal with that.
And, you know, something that I struggle with is like how to open up that conversation. Right. Where it's like, because like what you want to be is like, why are you so dumb? Like, why did you do that way? But like the thing that you have to be saying is like, hey, like you took this line. What were you like? What were you thinking during this specific sequence? Do you remember? Because I would love to understand it. To see if maybe you were correct. One of the things that really helped me with this was Quentin. So I would always ask Quentin about his plays, and he'd be like, well, that's just not what happened. And he would say, like, this is what happened. I'd be like, oh, well, I'm stupid. Like, ignore me. So something that I started doing is actually, like, when I'm watching him write down the things that were going on so that we could, get into real specifics. And this actually really helped me for multiple reasons. Because one, as I was writing things down while I wanted to ask Quentin questions after his match, I would just actually see what he saw. Sure. I would just be like, oh, as I'm writing this down, I get it. I get why you made this line. Keep going, man. You do you. Yep. Right? Like, and the thing is that when you are sitting in a match of Magic, you are immersed in that match, right? And those people that are watching you are not. But what's important is to try and find a way to let them help you.
So exactly.
Let's talk about the next thing here, which is something that people just don't do enough. They don't think about their sideboarding as to why they lost or how their sideboard's built or their sideboard in general. How many times have you played a tournament where you literally did not sideboard in 5 of the cards in your deck? In, like, a GP.
I top 16 to GP where I didn't touch 2 of my sideboard cards.
Were those sideboards correct to be in your sideboard?
No. I mean...
What happened?
I just, like, thought that they would be better than... I thought... They were just too cute. I thought they would be good, and then every time I had a chance to side them in, I was like, oh, boy, this seems super sketchy. And just never, I could never pull the trigger on it.
Like, what were they?
They were Memories Journeys in the sideboard of my Dredge deck.
Okay. There you go. Like, this happens to me all the time, where I'll be like, why did I have these in my sideboard? And it's like, you actually could say, could you have won more matches of Magic had you not just had those sideboard cards in your sideboard?
I mean, it couldn't have hurt. Like, I mean, I'm not going to lie and be like, oh, man, never mattered. Like, obviously, there were times I wish I had another sideboard card. And I think that a lot of that comes down to trying to make an actual plan where, like, instead of just saying, oh, I think these could be good sideboard cards, you're like, okay, so what matchups can I actually side this in? And especially with decks where it's really tight, like Dredge, you might end up saying, like, okay, well, I could sideboard it in these matchups, but I already have cards that I know are good in these matchups, and I just can't, you can't side in, like, 8 cards. It's just not a thing you can do.
Sure.
And that was basically, with those, that time, that was the problem. But I frequently had that issue, especially when I was newer to Magic, where, like, I'd have a card in my sideboard, and then when I would actually play a matchup, I'd just be like, is this card even good in this? Man, is this actually what this game is about? I'm not sure. I don't think so.
So... this is a real thing that I have. So I love Spell Queller out of the sideboard of my control decks. I love it a lot. But I have caught myself multiple times boarding in Fumigate and Spell Queller in the same matchup. So I'm like, all right, here's the deal. I need to pick a lane. Either I'm the Spell Queller deck or I'm the Fumigate deck. And what actually ends up happening is, like, on the play... or on the draw, depending on, like, what mana curve, what mana cost I'm worried about, I'm a Spell Queller deck, and the other ones, I'm a Fumigate deck or whatever, right? But you go get to be both.
Right. There's like very, very few matchups where and you were both spell coloring.
It's important that you figure out what you are in those situations.
Yeah, and I think that a lot of the time.
So let's kind of actually go on to deck lists. We might take a break really quick though. We'll be right back. Thank you everybody for your patience there. I actually thought Michael lost his connection, so I was talking to Mason. And then it turned out that I had lost my connection. So
that's right. That's right. For once, not me.
For once, it was me 3 weeks ago.
Yeah, no, it was me last week. So
yeah. Well, I think that sideboarding is something that people just kind of don't understand what they're supposed to be doing a lot of the time. And my recommendation for you is go write down a sideboard plan guide. Stop. Yeah, real advice. Stop messaging people with deck lists for their sideboard guides and take the time to write one down yourself with their deck list.
Yeah, do it. I mean, at
you
least then
learn so much.
At least then you just have an idea, right? I mean, it's not even necessarily important that your sideboarding is perfect in every matchup, but if you at least understand what you're trying to do, you can choose a role and try to play it.
And when you message them that sideboard guide, then you can actually have a conversation. Right?
Right.
Because what's important is the actual conversation, not the sideboard guide they hand you.
Yeah. Anyway. I mean, it. So, like, getting a sideboard guide is obviously, it can be helpful, especially if it's a deck you haven't played a lot before. But if you've played it very much, you basically understand what your role should be in all these different matchups. And, even people who've played a deck more than you, you're welcome to disagree on, like, what exactly your sideboard cards and role should be. Like, you have to be comfortable with the deck you're playing, ultimately.
It's true. I don't think I've ever agreed with the sideboard decision that Wes Singleton has made. Ever. Not one time. The guy wins PPDQs. Why does it matter? Like, he knows what he wants to be doing. That's what's important.
Right. I think that that's very true. Like, ultimately, the proof is sort of in the pudding on a lot of this stuff.
Yeah. I think that you will learn more from doing the work and putting in the work than you will grabbing somebody's sideboard card. So that's what I want to say on that. Let's wrap this up with two things. The last thing is just look at your deck list. Go over it. Did you have the right mana? Did you have the right removal composition? There are things that you can look at after an event or after preparation that says, did I do this correctly? Like, is this why I lost? Did I just play a bad deck? Michael, do you remember the first Magic tournament you won?
Like the first one?
Yep, the very first Magic tournament you won.
Since I started playing again?
Just ever. Do you, like, yeah, what, whatever, whichever.
Yeah, I remember the first Magic tournament I won.
So I literally was thinking about this in the car today, and I played Green-White Quest in the first Magic tournament I won. And what's important here is that I won the tournament with the deck. I had borrowed the deck from somebody else, and I went out and, like, it was literally the first Magic tournament I won. And I actually just went out and just bought the deck. I was like, I just won a Magic tournament with this deck. I'm going to buy it. And I went on to win a lot more Magic tournaments with that deck. I don't know that I ever changed a card in that deck.
Yeah.
I won a lot of matches with this deck. I literally got above a 1900 rating in the old Elo system, playing Magic probably six times a week. Which is really hard because you're just going to lose a lot of matches, which means you have to win a lot of matches. And I got my rating by the end of Elo to 2K, and most of it was on the back of this Green-White Quest deck. One of the reasons is because I had a really good matchup against Cobblade until I switched to Cobblade when Batter Skull was printed. But the important thing here is I never changed a card in my deck list. I don't think so. I think that other people played Birds of Paradise and stuff like that, and I'm just, no, like, I'm winning with this deck. My deck's good. Your deck's bad. And it was just a terrible mindset to have. And here's the thing. I probably could have qualified for a Pro Tour or for Worlds or all kinds of stuff had I just been willing to separate the fact that I was winning from my deck list and actually evaluating my deck still.
Yeah, a lot of it is about, like, you can win but not all wins are created equal. And like winning local events is one thing, but you know, if you're not playing PV a bunch of times, like, you know, it's nice that you're winning. I'm not saying it's a bad thing, but there's like a, where are we going to draw the line on what's good enough, and where should we really be getting stubborn over my way is the right way?
No, yes, exactly.
Right. I mean, if you've, you know, qualified for a Pro Tour with an exact deck list and then, you know, top 16, the Pro Tour with it or whatever, like, sure, you know, maybe your version really is the best. Like, it's got to be close. But I think understanding maybe if there's a reason, right? If you understand that, like, not playing Birds of Paradise changes this matchup in some fundamental way, but just sticking with something because it's been good in the past is a good way to just not really get any better.
Yeah, it's a real good way to not get any better. I think reflection is important, right? You can win a lot of matches of Magic, but if you don't look back on why you're winning or why you're losing, then you're never going to improve. And that's the important thing, is that like reflection is going to be key in all of this. Reflection on your process, reflection on your matches, reflection on everything. It just all encapsulate what you need to be doing to get better. And that can be pre and post, right? I need to reflect on... like we just talked about that sideboarding guy thing, right? And that can be a huge part of that. You need to do it before and after.
Absolutely. I think just like being cognizant of where your choices exist allows you to improve them in the future.
Yep. So that is it for this week's Training Grounds. Thank you everybody who's watching live right now. Let's wrap this up and go to our next goal on Patreon is probably going to change. I have been requested by a few people. All right, so here's the thing. I don't like putting fake goals on Patreon. But I really believe that the work that Mason, Michael, and Danny do is worth something. We have a new sponsorship offer, and I'm giving basically all of it to those guys. But I would like to get me and Danny and Michael as the host of the podcast for GPs more often at less money out of their pockets so that they can afford it. And so the form of payment that those people will be getting will be compensation for them to go to Magic events. So if you want to see Michael, Danny, Mason, myself, more Magic events, go to patreon.com/ccmtg. I promise that the quality of the show will improve when we go to more events, bigger events, more important events, and things like that. So that is the next goal, is to get these guys paid. That could change. But they deserve it. They work really hard. They put up with me. I'm an impossible human being. Just ask some of our listeners who no longer listen because apparently I'm the worst. but they really do deserve it. And so check them out, patreon.com/ccmtg. Michael, if you're not the worst, where can people find you?
I mean, I might be the worst. I don't really know. It's like it's a race to the bottom, and I'm not really sure. I got lost with all the other terrible people. You can find me on Twitter at MagicMikeMTG. You can also find me on Facebook. My name is Michael Hinderocker.
You can find me on Twitter at SpencerStephenH. You can find me on Facebook at Spencer Stephen Howland. You can find me every week here on Constructive Criticism, limited time only. You can find the podcast on mtgcast.com, twitch.tv/ccmtg every week live, and at 8 p.m. Eastern. And you can find the show and everything on constructivecriticism.com. Mason, unmute your mic. Tell people where they can find you, man. You deserve it.
All right, you can find me each week producing the show live on Twitch, as Spencer just said. You can also find me at on Twitter at SOVMason. And that's basically, you can also find me in the Facebook group on Constructed Criticism, Mason Clark. Yep. And always there, I'm always posting my Twitch. There you go.
Yeah, you can watch Mason stream. He streams like every day, so that's pretty cool. Yeah. You can find Mason and me and Michael all in our Discord channel, so check it out. There's a link on the contact page. And you can join the conversation by joining that Facebook group or that Discord channel, so check it out. #WouldThatBeGood is our Twitter outreach program. If you tweet it, we'll read it, as Michael likes me to say. All right, so yeah. I'm a little confused here. I feel like we read some of these tweets from May 24th, but it's the 29th, and that's only 5 days ago. Did we not read anything from the 24th?
No, we didn't read any of those.
All right, well, here we go. SCG Lockdown. CW is the sponsor for the Envy.
No. That was the 22nd.
All right.
The 24th, at Spencer13H, this is Andrew Elliott tweeting, I can confirm at SOV Mason is real. I kick his tail every F&M.
That's good. The fact that my joke has gotten to the point where people are talking about it on the internet is great.
Yeah.
I'm just saying, there was a person that was a fan of Austin Gotels, and that person was Mason. He was his only fan, so I just believed that it was Austin with a fake account.
Well, Austin has to fly a long way to play F&M every week, but it's probably worth it.
Just so he can have one fan. Now who's internet bullying? You.
I mean,
you are. Okay.
All right. I've already been told I'm the worst, so, you know. Gotta live up to that.
I said you're not the worst.
I got confused. My hearing is the worst, apparently.
I specifically said you are not the worst. Why don't you talk? Anyway, if by kicked he means punts away games for easy 2-0, then yes, hashtag wouldn't that be good. Are we about to get into watching Mason and Andrew get into a Twitter argument? Because I'm into that.
That would be good, yeah.
At QR's follower says, you should get a kilt, hashtag would that be good. This is for me saying the worst part of my day is having to put on pants. If you don't believe that, I just don't believe you're human. If you enjoy putting on pants every day, there are people that sleep in pants, Michael. Did you know this?
Yeah, I mean, I do that sometimes when I just fall asleep, but, you know.
Like, you get into bed with your jeans on?
Sometimes. Not usually, but, like, I don't know.
All right. I don't know how you could do that. I don't know. I don't know that I could do a kilt.
Yeah, I don't think other people would really... No one wants to see anyone in the kilt, I think, is actually the secret.
We might have people who wear kilts on listening to this podcast, Michael. That's all I'm saying. Yes. Practicing the Marvel Mirror. I think I got it down. Ready for the PPDQ. Hashtag would it be good. And it's just 8 seconds. All right. It's literally just Mason talking. Mason has way too many fidget spinners. This is what I just learned.
Yeah, two. Way too many.
You only need one. Did he just say he has 12?
I think he said his brother has 12.
I'll hop in real quick. They can hear me. Yeah, I have a baby brother they're both 6, and they have 12 between them. They love fidget spinners.
And that's 12 more than you 12? Need.
Hold on, I want one.
Why do you need 12 deck boxes?
I don't have
12 deck boxes.
I'm literally sitting here playing with a battery during the podcast. I definitely could use a fidget spinner.
I have a fidget cube.
Well, all right.
Oh, there you go. I'm gone.
All right. Andrew Elliott says, I turned to my Comcast to quit. I turned in my Comcast equipment today. Finally got tired of the BS. LOL. Took 45 minutes and 20 seconds of service.
Took 45 minutes for 20 seconds of service.
Oh,
I
see.
I hope your internet situation improves. I certainly have moments of being very upset with mine. So, you know, I understand the feeling.
All right. He also says, thinking of playing Jeskai Approach of the Second Sun at a PPDQ this Sunday, hashtag good, hashtag approach OP, hashtag control for D's, hashtag MTG. So here's the thing. I just got my tail kicked by Approach of the Second Sun. I just don't have room to talk. However, I think I was the only person he beat.
Well, that's because you talked down on it.
Here's the thing. Is in the world that we're in, Approach doesn't seem good. That doesn't mean that it can't be good. I specifically want it to be good.
Yeah, it doesn't seem great, but, you know, I don't know. I wouldn't play it, but I'm also not. Okay, so I think last time I talked to Austin, he was not that interested in playing it. And if Austin is not interested in playing a Dirdly control deck, it's almost certainly not good.
All right. The next tweet is just blatant abuse of hashtag would that be good by Mason Clark. It says this deck is crazy, hashtag would that be good. And it's a picture where the guy has some sweet stuff. He's got four main deck people through, some collective prudalities, some glory brown in it. What is this?
This is a deck that top 8 at GP Kobe.
It's just a bunch of Esper stuff.
Cards I own. Yeah, along with the this list and the affinity deck with the one main deck collected company were my favorite. I really like there's a Devour Flesh in this deck. Like, why?
So here's the thing. Casey and I were talking about this, and I wonder if, like, if I could learn Japanese and read Japanese articles, I wonder how much better I would be at Magic. Because here's the thing. I think that they actually just start at a different point of deck building than we as Americans do. So,
Yeah,
like,
but if
when
we
they
end up at
sit.
a point of deck building where you register Glorybound Initiate in your modern deck, I don't know that I'm that into it.
Dude, what do you know? He top-aided.
Well, any
I'm just
given
teasing
Sunday,
you.
as they say.
I'm just saying, like, what if we could have the best of both worlds? What if I could understand what in the world these people were thinking and understand, like, what Americans think? Because here's the thing. Japanese Magic players are very, very, very good at Magic. They're dominant in a lot of ways. But I look at so many reg like there was a time where people were literally playing Lee of Sky Knight, Esper aggro decks with Supreme Verdict, and I literally don't know why. In my head, I cannot figure out what in the world the deck is good against. And when I look at this deck list, I don't understand it.
Yeah, I don't really either, but
I don't
I so
know
it
what
just
any of this is for.
it depends on what you're playing against, I guess. I mean, Painful Truths is certainly powerful and it like
You're
fuels your
playing
collective
23
brutalities.
lands with a Celestial Colonnade.
I think 23 is fine if you're gonna play a bunch of Painful Truths.
Did you get the 3 mana?
You usually get to three with 23. I don't know. I don't think the mana of this deck is bad. This guy also, for what it's worth, apparently has two PT top 32s as well as at least one more GP top 8. So maybe this deck is actually great. It I don't know. There's something to be said for playing something that you know how to play.
All right. Well,
Right?
guys, yes, there is. That is it for this week. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Thank you, everybody, for watching live. You can go support us on Patreon, through PayPal, go to the swag store, buy some t-shirts. Everything is really appreciated, and we will see you guys all next week.
See you guys.
Magic, magic, magic.